and welcome to Susie Explores, a podcast with me, Susie Collier. Today, my guest is the director, coach, teacher, recitalist, composer, Alison Devenish. We met once before this podcast when we sat next to each other at a Royal Academy of Music awards ceremony. We just knew that we wanted to carry on having the conversation we had that day. And I'm delighted to say that in this podcast, we explore so much of what it is to feel whole in the education process, both as a student and as a teacher. I mean, not only is it just really lovely to see you, we haven't seen each other since the summer, and that's in fact when we first met, which is just a funny thing. But yes, we've just been setting up this recording and stuff, and I think about your WhatsApp status, and your WhatsApp status is in your own time. You probably don't remember even doing this.
No.
But it's actually delightful. And, you know, it's not that I look at people's statuses at all, really, but yours just came up as being a thing. And I think that's really rather wonderful, because we decided we'd take a little time just to make sure everything was recording properly and it was all good. And your WhatsApp status says that. Do you remember doing that? Do you remember setting that?
I don't remember setting it, but it is actually something that I say a lot, alternately, flippantly, but also meaning it not just for myself, but for others. I think it's probably now about not running around like a headless chicken anymore, practically speaking, because I just don't have the energy to do that. But also, you know, stuff happens in your own time. So just learn to be okay with that.
But do you think that's because, I would agree with you, but do you think that's partly because we've lived some years and we can look back and just think, well...
Oh, yes. Yes, very much so. This is, to say it now is a luxury. You know, if somebody had said that, well, I tell you what, if somebody had said that to me 25, 30 years ago, I would have smiled politely and then gone off running around like a headless chicken, because everything has to be done yesterday and something could happen if I don't do it now and I might miss something or somebody might miss me, and then the world would stop turning and it would all fall apart. And then you live a couple of years or a few more than that and the world has still kept on turning, you know, in your own time.
It has kept on turning. It's really, really true. But are you saying to me that you are never a headless chicken now? I mean, I get it. You know, you're saying, oh, you know, hey, you know, I don't necessarily have the energy anymore, but it's more than that. It's a mindset. But are you saying you're never a headless chicken?
You know, I think one thing that is the benefit of time and years and growing up is becoming more aware of when is the right time to be a headless chicken.
Yeah.
To learn how to choose the right time to up your energy, to pursue, to really chase. And when it's okay to not sit back and let things go by, but to sit back and observe and to watch and then decide. And that is a benefit of time. And age, definitely.
I think really that what you're saying is that it's really okay to be a headless chicken, but you need to be really conscious and discerning about what decisions you make at any given time. Because it's true, sometimes opportunities just come along and we say, you know something, we will embrace it.
Yes.
But that's not really being hit over the head with it. That is just saying, okay, this is going to be high octane. It's going to be tough for a bit, but I've decided positively to make that decision.
Very much so. I think, you know, I often now, I realize when I'm working with younger people, I remember that feeling of being worried that I might miss something.
Well, the FOMO, fear of missing out. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. You know, if I don't take every single job that comes up.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this could be the end of the career that I have yet to identify. But just in case, I'll do all of that plus a little bit more. And it takes, I think, a certain amount of bravery to say, no, it's okay. I'll wait. It's all right. This doesn't suit me. This won't make me happy. This won't do anything for me. I'll hang on till the next bus comes. Thank you so much.
But if, as far as waiting for buses are concerned, that's a tricky one, really, because there's a philosophy, and you know what it's like. You know, when we would stand outside the Royal Academy of Music, you'd wait for the bus to come, and you think, well, look, is it quicker to walk, or is it quicker to do this, or is it quicker to do that? Yeah. But there was always a kind of a pressure to make a decision. Now you're saying that it could be okay to just let that bus go and to take a different route. But do you think that when we were students, that we were encouraged to take every job? Because I certainly felt that pressure that to be a rounded and complete person, I actually had to take every job, no matter what it was. And I had to run myself ragged in order to do that, because it would make me more complete as a human being. So that's an interesting one, isn't it?
That sounds very familiar. You know, I think when I was a student here, weirdly, I didn't get that kind of feeling. Oh, that was me. I didn't get that feeling from my teachers specifically, but it was an atmosphere and a sort of energy that I felt whenever I was in that building. And at the time, it was exciting, perhaps because everybody else felt like that as well.
Oh, so
we were all sort of running around slightly crazed and dazed. And you don't really notice. It feels right.
Normal. It feels like normal, I think.
And normal, right? And I think that's unfortunate. And isn't it sad that the dangerous thing is to sit back? That's the dangerous thing to do at that time.
But then perhaps we need to be thinking about the syntax we're using, because you're saying, you know, to sit back perhaps is not great, and it was not great in that situation. But earlier on, you said to sit and observe is a really good thing. So maybe it's the way that we're actually describing it. I think maybe in the days when we were students, to sit back was not a good thing. But I'd say even now, sitting back feels like it has negative connotations. Whereas to sit and observe and to wait until it feels the right time feels so much more positive.
As you're saying that, I'm remembering there was at the time I was there, the head of piano, Alex Kelly. I remember I used to have a lot. He wasn't my teacher, but we used to have lots of conversations for some reason. And it was always about going out and looking at things. We used to talk about exhibitions. We used to talk about, you know, looking at particular buildings, looking at architecture. It was about looking and watching and observing. And you're right. It is the vocabulary, the sitting back has a sort of that kind of thing. Whereas sitting and taking in still has you upright. It still has you present. It still has an energy about it. And that is actually what I mean. Because sitting up and watching and observing does not mean you then have to get up and go chasing. You're still taking it all in. You know?
I agree. But it's also, it's not passive. It's actually active, isn't it?
Exactly. And I think that that's important. But still, you know, to capture and be okay with that feeling as a young musician in college is scary and a little daunting. And I think that it should be actively encouraged, I think, that it's okay to look and to watch and to take some time.
I really think that those are wise words indeed. So I wonder whether, you know, we were part of a conservatoire system, which I think may have changed. It may have changed. And you have contact with young people now. I have contact with young people now. We see them going into the senior conservatoires. I wonder whether for them it actually does feel different, or whether we need to be doing so much more to make sure that the thing that really underpins their studenthood is a feeling of being all right in themselves, and that in order to flourish as themselves, they need to take time and they need to observe and they need to be looking at other situations rather than turning inwards and feeling pressurized.
You know, I'm not 100% convinced that institutions as a whole are really embracing that kind of thinking. I think the kids who enter are much more autonomous in terms of what they want and who they are, more so than I think than when I was there as a student. It's interesting, though, I think that conservatories, universities, academics, arts, the pressure on learning generally, anyway, for young people is huge. As a, I'm sure you must recognize this as a parent, certainly myself as a parent, just hearing and feeling, certainly my kids as they were about to enter university, and hearing the language of, well, I have to do, and I must do, and yes, everybody else is, and so on. And again, with the benefit of my age, you know, I'm thinking, it'll be okay. You're allowed to sit, watch, observe, make mistakes, make a couple of wrong choices, come back, do a full circle, and off you go. I think that my experience now, when I'm now dipped back into various conservatoires and other institutions, is that I suspect that they are still struggling with the ethos and the point of things. Mm-hmm. I think individuals, both students and teachers, are probably more than they were before on this track of space and time. But I think that as a whole, institutions possibly might still need to figure out what the point of that building and those four walls are.
Okay. So there's a building and there's four walls, and these buildings exist in many parts of the world. And within them, you have these students who would really love to feel like they are carving away into the musical world. And you're right. I think students are more autonomous. I think they are possibly more thoughtful about what it feels like to be a whole person. I think there is a great interest in the body, the mind and spirit all as a whole. That's really great. But what do we need to do? What do we need to do as guides, mentors, people who bump into us, people who work with us? What can we do to actually ensure that students feel empowered, but also that we are instigating change in these places with our relationships with the staff, as well as the students? What have we got to do now in order to make these places four walls of wonderful and bountiful wholeness and creativity?
One of the most fun things I do or ask that still gives me a surprise with the response is when I'm coaching or teaching, and I say to a young person, well, what do you think? And they always look surprised that I'm asking them and that they are allowed to tell me.
Absolutely.
And combine that with, you know, one of the, my teacher at the academy was Ruth Hart. And one of the things that I have taken with me, and I say to anybody who cares to listen, and she used to tell me that whatever decision you make is valid as long as you believe it. Nobody can question your decision, but you also have to believe it, which then leads to, what do you think? Because if you know what it is you want to say, so imagine telling an entire student body, make some decisions about what you want to perform, about how you want to communicate, about what you want to say, how you want to play. Work out how you want to do that. Be strong and assured with what decision you've made. Now do it. And I always say to people that I'm working with, I can't argue with you. I don't have to agree with you, but I'm not going to argue with you if you believe that, because I will be taken by the conviction of that decision. And that, I mean, that's like having a really good conversation. It's not about an argument, but it's about receiving the ideas and doing something with them and then tossing them back like a tennis match. And I feel certainly that my responsibility as a teacher, as a coach, as a performer, is to open that door to let people in and then let them know about the ball I'm playing with, and then toss it back to them, see what they think about it. And then the game begins, and the conversation starts, and the communication starts, and the reception is easy. So an entire building of kids who can think and play and own their decisions and own their communication. As a coach and a teacher, my job, I think, is to not dampen that down.
Yeah.
And not to close the door and to just continually encourage that.
I couldn't agree more, but maybe some people who are listening to this would say that it's quite a scary thing to allow such vibrant energy to be not just a part, but the actual root of the conversation. Because I agree. The thing is that if Ruth, lovely Ruth Hart, who is so beloved at the Academy, I never, ever heard anybody say anything other than lovely things about her, because she really was lovely. You come to a decision. It is valid as long as you believe it. You experiment with these ideas and you put them out in the world. You go to your masterclass or your lesson. You say, I haven't practiced the things that you told me to do, but this is what set me alight. I mean, can you imagine? I know you're laughing, but isn't it funny?
No, I'm imagining it. No, I'm imagining the horror of that, which is, you know, but your recital's in 4 weeks. And you haven't heard the Beethoven yet.
Yes.
You know, but again, look, it's sort of like, I guess, you have a baby, you have a toddler, and there's that, you know, we run around putting the guards in the sockets, right? So that they don't stick their tongue in there, their finger or something like that. You know, it's the difference between, I suppose, a kind of parenting where you're like, let them get shocked, then they'll never do it again, versus, you know, I would like you not to get shocked, you know, because I don't want to be in the hospital and neither do you, and so on. There's that line, there's that fence that you walk of guidance that comes with offering experience and inevitable knowledge from years. And at some point, you have to hand it over. At some point, you have to say, well, that's great that, you know, you had masses of ideas, but also you need to learn that Beethoven for the recital in 4 weeks.
Absolutely.
So my suggestion is you practice the Beethoven. Because also, you know, at this point that we're talking about, when kids are in, you know, post-secondary in conservatories and so on, they need to have a little responsibility for their actions and their thought. And yes, I still think we should be having these conversations, but there's also, with the sitting and the watching and the observing, an awareness of the surroundings, of what goes on, of what the, I hesitate to say rules, but what the boundaries might be.
Right.
And can we stretch the boundaries? And can we, you know, how far do we push them out? And what does it do to everybody else? But also, what does it do for me to do?
Right.
Because I think the boundaries should be, I'll tell you a story. When I was at the Academy, I had come from undergraduate in the States. And I was playing with a cellist. And I remember having a discussion, two women, you know, should we match, matchy-matchy when we play this recital? What are you wearing? And she was talking about this particular dress that she had. And I looked at her and I said, why are you wearing a dress? You're a cellist, your legs that way. And she said, oh, but the Academy, you can't wear trousers. And I thought, who said that? Now, I mean, I'm saying it now, and I feel that is as absurd now as it was then. And I remember trying to say, just wear the trousers, because nobody's paying attention to that. They're going to be paying attention to you playing. That's the whole point of this. And it was interesting, I think, that I couldn't understand was the fear was around that, and not about the actual performance. Now, that's opposed to, I don't know, assuming that you're going to be playing a cello recital and you come in because last week you thought, you know what, I really wanted to play the oboe, so I'm going to do it all in the oboe today, having never played the oboe. That's a boundary you might not want to stretch. Playing in trousers, I think, is okay. Those are two extremes, but I just think, you know, take in everything. And then decide what is going to aid you and help you move forward without sort of knocking down the walls and blowing up the building or anything like that. But it, I mean, and as I'm saying this, I'm realizing this is, you know, that's a lot. That's a lot for young people, where especially when you go into a conservatory and it's just mostly 99.9% about practicing and playing perfectly and whatever else they feed you as you're coming up. But sometimes that's what I mean. You just need to just take a step back and, I don't know, maybe have a fisheye lens view as opposed to the really focused macro kind of thing.
Well, I think that the idea of taking in everything and then having a look and seeing what might aid you is indeed helpful. I also think I agree it can be overwhelming. And actually, one person's, you know, a few decades ago, one person's decision to whether to wear trousers or not, whether that was just too daring, hopefully that is no longer an issue. And at that time, very sadly, it was an issue for that particular woman. And that is sad. But I think the equivalent of the trousers is still here now. So it's, well, you know, my profile on Instagram just isn't very strong and I'm not getting the followers and maybe I'm not wearing the right clothes when I play and I record this stuff. And I think unfortunately, it's all still here. So the idea really that I am receiving from what you're actually imparting is that freedom is a really wonderful thing to be able to take in everything and then to be able to think about where you might fit in or what you might want. But that takes a huge amount of strength to discern. And I think going back to my question of, you know, what could we do within these four walls of all these conservatoires around the world now to encourage is that I think that the advice and the TLC and the wisdom that needs to surround these students is all about actually giving options. So I hear you. I hear what you're saying right now, but you have got to play the Beethoven in 4 weeks' time. So look, let's just look at this all. But that's not you just pointing the finger and saying, you will do that. What you're trying to do is you're trying to say, look, you've looked at how your life is feeling right now. You felt creative in a completely different way. You've brought something completely different to the lesson. That's great. I think that the student in that situation wants to be listened to. But then what needs to happen is maybe you need to be giving that wonderful kind of more like world picture of global. This is kind of what's happening now. How do you feel? You know, it really is 4 weeks. Your hands really in. Things are feeling really, really great. Now, how do you feel? And actually by enabling that person to see a bit more of what's actually happening, they will have the strength of mind to know what truly is right for them in that situation. And it's not necessarily what they brought you at the beginning of the lesson.
Well, exactly. I mean, as you were speaking, I was thinking, you know, if we're throwing out an option of freedom, with it should come also responsibility.
Yeah.
And responsibility, not just to the outside world, the four walls, etc., but also to yourself. And again, that comes back to perhaps an ever-growing sense of responsibility, sense of awareness, sorry, of what the point is. I mean, and again, as I'm laughing because I'm thinking if anybody had this conversation with me when I was 22, I would just look at them, wait for their mouth to stop moving and go, right, are we having the lesson now? Let's get on with it. but that, you know, sort of, but it is that benefit of age and experience and working out what works for you and doesn't leave you spent so that you can do more of what you actually like to do.
Okay. So how are we going to be keeping that wonderful curiosity and creativity alive within the confines of life, within the confines perhaps of an educational system, within the confines of society right now? How are we going to really be making sure that we feed rather than squash?
I will go back to that, my favorite question to everybody, which is, well, what do you want to do? And I ask that both to the, you know, the 20-something-year-olds that I'm coaching and also my 7-year-old piano student. And they're very different answers, of course.
Yeah.
And then, you know, especially to the babies that I teach, I say, well, look, my job is to help you figure out doing what you'd like to do. We're not going to go crazy. You know, you're not going to start playing out like Jerry Lee Lewis with your hands behind your back. But let's figure out what he was doing so that he got to that point. And then you can maybe redefine what you want to do. And then we can go from there. It's a constant. I think it's constant. The listening, the observing, the communicating. There is no pat answer. And perhaps, you know, this is both the joy and the risk of institutions and the numerous people within it, both students and teachers, because it is so individual. You know, you have one studio, one teacher, 15 students, say. That's 15 individual ways of communicating and talking and having that conversation and going through the what do you want. It can't be that if all 15 were bringing in that same Beethoven sonata, that you're going to have the same answer for each of them. One of them might be all about the 9 hours of practice, and one might say, I spent the past 2 weeks visiting every museum in London. And each one has to, as myself as a teacher and a mentor and a coach and so on, is to say, well, what's that done for you then? And we still have those 4 weeks. So can we take all of what's been going on for you and put it back into this? Because when we go to the responsibility bit of the freedom, the responsibility is you got this recital. So we need to work towards that. But let's see if we can start to bring back home everything, all those experiences. But that's 15 different experiences.
Absolutely, yes.
It's a big job for the teachers in these buildings, you know. I think that it's interesting when we started out and I said, I right now in this present are these conservatoires changing, meeting these new kinds of kids, perhaps. And I think that the whole concept of the ethos of an institution perhaps is what has to change about offering this kind of freedom plus responsibility to all of those kids who enter in through those doors. And I think because there's a certain kind of safety that can then be offered to them.
Got it. Yeah. Mm. I love the idea of safety. I also love the idea of a teacher having 15 students all bring the same piece. And actually, every relationship we have with anybody in this world is bespoke. And the moment that we feel that it isn't, and it's just going to be kind of, right, you bring me this and I'm going to give you this, then something's wrong because active listening isn't actually happening. But then you talk about the word safety, and that's a really, really big thing. And I think those who are young and thinking about moving forward in their youth to adulthood and what that might mean, safety is a huge thing. And I think our awareness of safety is perhaps more finely tuned than it was a few years ago. I think we're really thinking about protecting young people whilst also wanting to give them freedom. But I want to know what you feel we need to do in our society. You know, we both live in London, and within the conservatoires, what can we do about really understanding diversity in a way that is not tokenistic, is really all-encompassing, and is absolutely fair, and makes people and enables people to feel safe?
At the very basic level, I think my immediate knee-jerk response is, I don't want to have this conversation anymore.
No, it should, well, I know. I realize.
No. Not in terms of you and I having this conversation, but in when
no,
it,
but
when
we
it gets
in a bigger in, way. Yeah, absolutely.
In a bigger way, when it comes out, you know, on pieces of paper with headlines or whatever, because my go-to response is always if you have to talk about it, if you're still talking about it, you're probably not doing anything.
Yeah,
if you just get on and do it. You know, I think I am very lucky. I grew up in a house and in a family and a sort of a familial tradition that everything was possible and available to you. And your only response, your main responsibility was to just put 100% effort in. With that knowledge was also that I'm Black, and I certainly, at the time I grew up, my parents' generation and my parents as immigrants to Canada, we were also aware that you are going to put in 110 or 120%. And then you might equal the 100%. Okay. Now, I am in classical music, and 2022, still, kind of foisted out there as not quite normal yet, more normal than when I was growing up. But I think that certainly I'm not about having to justify my place in here and what I do. Because I do what I do, because I like what I do, and I happen to be kind of good at it, so I'm going to keep going, right? I think that one of the things that shocked me when I moved here and I was teaching in schools was hearing, not just from different races, but different social backgrounds, that phrase of, well, it's not for me, we don't do that, which I'd never heard in my life. And I still hear that. It's not really, it's not what we do, And I think, well, it's what you're going to do here in my presence because you like it. So we put that to this side and we get on. I think when you get to bigger and higher levels where institutions are on some levels busy doing a bit of a tick box exercise, I'm not sure that offers safety for expression. It doesn't always present a safe space for any kind of vulnerability. And we're in the arts and in the performing arts. So, you know, people are lucky that we actually put clothes on in the morning because otherwise we're just naked expressing everything left, right, and center.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the responsibility of these institutions of higher learning in the arts, their responsibility is to just teach the kids who want to learn. That's it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter where they come from or what they look like. They're there because they want to do this. So why are we talking about the other stuff? This is the one, it's a conservatoire. It's about learning music and performing and communicating. So why are we talking about all the other stuff? It might come in, it might inform their communication, what they want to say and so on. But it's not a statistical exercise. Yeah. It shouldn't be a statistical exercise. And I think that, you know, so many factors that end up circling around, as I said, the statistics of we have this many from here and this many from here and so on, overshadow too much this potential joy in the sharing and the performance and the communication and the playing with each other and with the audiences and the and everybody else is too worried about whether, you know, do we have too many kids from the Far East or from the East End of London or what social classes have we gotten here? What's the economic status of that child? Don't care. They came because they wanted to learn the piano. So my job is to kind of teach them the piano.
Yeah. Safety is a funny thing then, isn't it? Because I agree, why are we still talking about what it feels like to be women in society? Mm. Never mind any other part of diversity that we need to be thinking about. I really think that you're right. If we're not careful, we overshadow or rub out the potential joy of communication in all its forces. But I love the idea that you're saying that safety actually encompasses the idea of being able to express yourself, but also the idea that safety in its true form can mean that you can be vulnerable. And this is nothing to do with status, race, color, anything, nothing comes into this. This is something that is really raw and absolutely vital.
Absolutely. And I think if you know, if you're entering into a building with the knowledge that it might not be safe to express yourself, how stifling is that? I mean, you might as well just enter in a straitjacket and be sort of stood against a corner in the wall. I mean, it's ludicrous. It's, we do what we do because, you know, hopefully we have gotten to a point where we feel safe to say what we would like to say and then be able to go home at night, right?
Yes.
And this thing about, you know, as I said, with Ruth saying, you know, you own your decisions and so on, there's a safety in that, and then delivering that decision, because you know it's okay that people will take it. They don't, and again, they don't have to agree with it, but they'll receive it. That is being safe. And again, it comes with age. Right now, I am playing what I like to play. I'm working with people that I like to work with. I'm performing in places that I'd like to play to, audience that I'd like to play to, because I am sure of what I want to deliver and I feel safe in delivering it. I feel safe in having these conversations with my colleagues. I feel safe in performing that music because I can open myself to it, but I'm not worried about what's going to come back. And to give that to somebody young as they're coming up, I think is huge. Of course it changes and it's fluid and it goes, you know, it's going to change till I die. But to come into this now, it's not like I think, oh my God, I wasted my 20s. I didn't waste my 20s, but I like how it feels now. I like it very much. Very much. You know, and it's not that I'm doing only stuff that I like. I'm definitely doing stuff where I'm grinding my teeth and biting my nails down, rolling my eyes and going, oh my God, why did I take this? And running around like a headless chicken because the deadlines are coming in and all of that kind of stuff. But at the core of it is I chose to do this. I chose to be in this situation. It's all mine. I didn't just kind of fling myself into the wind and cross my fingers and hope. So the heart might still go, the adrenaline might still be going up, but there's something about this ownership and autonomy that is so important. And it creates at the core of everything a particular kind of calm, which I think is the best, I think, lesson to pass on.
Okay, I really understand that, you know, ownership and autonomy in the best sense, that does lead to a calm, because actually, it's taking off the pressure of, am I really doing the right thing? Because you've made a decision, you've owned that. But let's go back to the situation of the person who is meant to be playing Beethoven in a month. And it is not their decision. It's not their choice. It is something that they are being recommended to do, because actually to go through that experience could be not necessarily life-changing, but it will actually enable you to learn something which you won't if you don't do it. Now, that's different, because that's not taking, it's not taking ownership of a decision in the way that you might now, but I still believe you can take ownership of that by accepting that what somebody is saying to you can make coherent sense. But it's a slightly different thing, isn't it? Because you don't know what you're going into. You are accepting that somebody's words may have some wisdom which you can't quite see right now. So that's slightly different, isn't it?
Well, you know, part of getting to, I think, a place of, to the place that I'm speaking of where I feel I am now, is also the necessity, I think, of doing what you don't want to do.
Yeah.
Because at the very worst, at least you learn what you don't want to do. And then in the future, you can decide not to do it.
Okay.
But sometimes, of course, sometimes we have to do what we don't want to do. Sometimes, and then it might be about a conversation about, okay, well, what do you need to do for yourself to get to that 4 weeks?
Yes.
You might not ever play this Beethoven again, but you got to do it in 4 weeks. So what do you need to do to get to a point where you feel quite good about playing it? And then you can let it go. Because we all have these deadlines, these guidelines. I mean, and they're anything from, gosh, writing an essay to, you know, doing that temp job for 3 months because you need the money to go traveling. Or, I don't know, taking the slow train because it's cheaper, but it will get you to the destination anyway, but it's going to take 4 more hours. So you say, okay, I've got these 4 extra hours. Oh my God, it's stopping absolutely everywhere. I wonder if I could take some work with me and kind of get it out of the way. You know, I'm not saying, of course, it doesn't all fall nicely like that. But hey, you know what? There's a lot of times when we've got to do stuff we don't want to do. So how do we make it slightly less yuck?
Yeah.
You know, and that in itself is its own thing about growing up and learning stuff and owning decisions. It all feeds in.
But isn't it about how we perceive yuck? So we can perceive yuck. Do you know what I mean? So we're saying, actually, this isn't very nice. This is just yuck, which was probably one of my favorite words when I was growing up. But actually, it was partly me perceiving things as being yuck. I think what you're saying is that we can be enabled to really understand that although we might perceive it as being yuck, it really isn't. And it's kind of demystifying that. Like, there's a lot of fear in saying, oh, that's just yuck, I don't want to do it, or I don't want to eat it, or I don't want to be there, or I don't want to go there or see this person.
But you know what? When I hear that, my immediate question is, why don't you like it? Right?
Yes.
I mean, again, I'm sure, again, you as a parent with a, you know, when the toddler is like, yeah, I don't want to eat that. And you're like, the easiest thing would be to, I'll take that plate away. Let me just get some food in you and we'll go. But then there's that time when you're like, wait, why don't you like that? And it's because it's green. It's because it's wet. It's because it's like, okay, well, you know, we can do this and then it might not be so yuck. And then suddenly, you know, the cucumber isn't so awful anymore. And it could have gone the other way where you just never serve them cucumber ever again. Mm. And they got to their 30s and they were like, I don't know why I don't eat cucumber. I think, so with the Beethoven, yeah, you don't want to play it. You haven't been practicing it. Da-da-da. Okay, you've got to do it in 4 weeks. What is it about this that you don't like? What is it about this style, this particular sonata? Is it this period of music? What is it?
But surely so much of this comes to either a well-founded or an unfounded sense of fear. So in the same way that I don't want to touch that cucumber because, frankly, this is just not my thing. I don't go for something like that. You're not really experiencing it fully in order to even discover really whether that's true. But with the Beethoven, it could be, well, I've only ever played Brahms and I'm quite comfortable doing that. And I don't think I have the sound for this, or somebody's accused me of not having a classical enough sound, or it's competitive and I know I'm not going to win, or I have too many things going on for me to even think about memorizing parts of it to feel comfortable. There could be so many things, couldn't there? So in terms of what do you need in order to maybe give the cucumber a try or to give Beethoven a try, I think... Then we come back to the safety thing, because that person who you are ministering to or you're listening to needs to feel safe enough to say, actually, you know something?
Yeah.
I am so worried about doing this and I think I'm going to just do an appalling job.
Yes. Yeah. And that is a completely different discussion to the one that could have happened in the first 5 minutes of the lesson, which would be, well, you've got to learn it. You've got to go back. Don't come into this lesson until you've learned it again.
Yes.
That's a completely different end of that situation.
Yes.
And I think it's about time. And I'm not talking huge swathes of time, but you have to have time to listen, to offer the space, to go, So just quite literally, why? Why?
You can ask the question why in so many different ways. You can ask it in a really pointy finger accusatory why, or it can be kind of, listen, I'm here. There is this space and time for you. Yeah. I actually really do want to know why. And it's not because I'm going to judge you, but I need to understand before we can find a way forward together. You're not isolated in this.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, I can think of countless times when I've been, you know, over the years, coaching singers, and they've come in and I just can't get this phrase, and then and you know, we go through various technical things and expressive things and so on, and then you just kind of look up and you go, so what's going on? And it's got nothing to do with the song or the technique or anything. The car broke down, something's wrong with their partner or their mother, or they've lost their dog or something like that. And again, this is about, you know, the whole vulnerability, which is, it's whole person, it's whole body. And it affects absolutely everything, from whether they can get that high note to whether your brain has the space to learn the Beethoven.
Yes.
And we won't know unless we say why or how or what's going on, or let's talk about something else, or, you know, we don't know. And perhaps this is an issue that would hit any institution, which is we have all of these people. We have all of these students. We have all of these teachers. We have all of that administration and so on. Is there time for all of these 15 students playing the same Beethoven for the teacher to go, so what's going on, when we all have 4 weeks?
Yes.
Who takes that time?
But you see, that's a great rhetorical question. But I'd say that rhetorical question just needs to be reminded to us. So it needs to kind of blink up in front of you, because I actually think there is time to check in with every person we ever interact with. But it doesn't mean that we need to wear our hearts on our sleeves. It doesn't mean that we need to wear a badge just saying, I'm having the most awful day. This is what's happened for the last week. And actually, I'm feeling vulnerable and not worthy of everything. You don't have to do all that. But I think checking in sometimes can just be a look of understanding and compassion and a lack of judgment in one comment that you give that person. So I think it's very easy to imagine that in order to really look at the whole person, we're going to be spending all your lesson times 15 for all those people who are doing the Beethoven in 4 weeks, spending, not doing any playing, but literally just talking about it. And that is not necessarily the case. It doesn't have to take time. I think it's got a lot to do with our own attitude about how we go into the room with each of those 15 people, knowing that actually we need to be coaching them to do this thing, which is a pressure in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. But if we are both teacher and student entering the room, and the room is already acknowledged as a place of safety, sometimes conversation doesn't have to be that long at all.
That's right.
You know, the shorthand can come up, and it could be, you know, how you doing? And it's like, oh, not a great day. All right. Should we have a go then? Yeah. All right.
End.
Because it's been okay to just shrug your shoulders.
Yeah,
you don't have to come in and, you know.
No, but shrugging shoulders can be, it's just the big word, which is acknowledgement. And acknowledgement sometimes is just the key that we need to just feel, again, safe. Yeah. No matter who we are in this world, we're safe. Yeah. However far we think we're going to be traveling up the professional line to be who we feel we need to be, maybe there is space to realize that we are going to get where we need to get to, because we are as we are.
Not we are as we are. And I think, you know, one of the joys I have in the work that I do is finally seeing the person that I'm working with be who they are.
Yeah, it's magic, isn't it?
You know? It's amazing. You sort of, you go, oh, okay, there you are. Okay, now let's do this stuff. You know, it's great. It's fantastic. It's like somebody arriving at your door all bundled up in a coat and a snowsuit and the whole bit. And then this third, fourth, fifth skin comes off and you're like, oh, okay, now let's get to work.
Yeah.
That's always amazing. And it comes from little things. It comes from actually learning the Beethoven. It comes from, you know, when I think of my the kids that I teach, the little ones, that they pass their GCSE exam. And now they can take that big worry off, and now we can actually do some work. Right?
Yes.
And it's just for me saying, how did it go today? You're all right. Was the exam hard? Or, you know, singers that I work with, how was the journey? Was it all right? Trains were a mess today, aren't they? But now we can go. It's not that difficult. I mean, part of me is like, it's not that difficult. It's just, you know, be a nice person. just be nice,
yeah,
and be kind and give space.
Mm.
You know, it's not that difficult. And again, it, all of that, these actions that I hope that I'm always able to give out, they also inform what I do myself and how I want to then communicate the work that I'm doing.
Right.
It's you know, just be nice.
I love it.
It's not saying Sesame Street.
But no, they do, you know, and I think it's important. And I think kindness is important. And I think space is important. But I think you're really right when you say that the way that we really are with the people that we meet informs really who we are. Because
absolutely,
you can't really actively listen to your student or another human being without letting go of your own needs. And I think that we as enablers, we need to remember that. And actually, I think
my gosh, yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes. I think, you know, my biggest bugbear with these institutions of higher learning is that a lot of personal agendas need to leave the room.
Yes.
And because it's not about you. If you are there to teach these kids, it's not about you.
Mm.
Otherwise, don't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I often think that my job in terms of coaching and teaching is to get these people to a point where, when I say they don't need me, but they're ready to move on. I've given everything that I can, they've taken it, and now their job, they need to go off and find something else, move on to the next rung, open up another door and so on. I don't need to keep them. I'm not going to keep them in a corner and dust them off. They're not mine. My job is to do that.
Yes.
And often I find in these conservatories and universities and so on that there's a bit of this, which can feel warm and, you know, but I'm not convinced that it's 100% safe.
I agree.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do agree. And actually, for those who are just listening to this podcast rather than watching, it was really beautiful because you said basically that our job is to, and you put your hands out and you said really to just give out and to let them and to let them fly, essentially. And then the other action that you said was it was like a more of a kind of a hug, encompassing.
Yeah.
And that's what you're explaining as being not necessarily the space that you need in order to really flourish. So I just wanted to make that point because I think it's such an important one. And in fact, those two physical actions can mean very different things. Because sometimes in order to put your arms out in that way can mean a kind of a, I don't need this. This is going away. And actually to make the embracing gesture is something that just says, look, it's really okay. I can draw you to me because it feels the right thing.
There is the responsibility for the person who's doing those actions.
Yay.
What do you mean? Right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm sending you off. I'm not flinging you away. I'm offering you a safe space. I'm not holding you so tight that you can't leave.
Yes.
And that is the responsibility. And it can be misinterpreted, but my job is to keep it as clear and as open and as fluid as possible. You know, and of course, not everybody's going to agree with me, and they don't have to, and they can go because that's what they do when they own that decision.
Yeah.
Right? We're not for everybody, and that's okay. Teachers are not for everybody, and that's okay. And institutions are not for everybody, yeah. and that is also okay.
Mm.
You know? And again, part of the growing up and the ownership of decisions is hopefully feeling safe enough to go, oh, you know what? I'm not sure about this. I might go, you know? I might be back, but right now I might need to go. Because I don't feel safe here. I don't feel comfortable here. I don't feel able to figure out stuff here. And that's okay too, you know? And I think that there is strength then on the other side to say, all right, be safe, see ya. That's also a big deal too.
Mm. I love it. And do you realize that during this conversation, we haven't talked about anything to do with what we do in our lives or even how we met? And it's just been absolutely delicious. But I do want to say for the record that we did meet at the Royal Academy of Music Awards ceremony, and where we were both bestowed fellowships, and we had to wear strange hats and cloaks. And
yes. Oh my gosh, yes.
You know, there's you and me and Lin-Manuel Miranda and various other people who were just kind of lining up, sort of not knowing really what was going to happen at all. But there was some spark that I felt sitting next to you and speaking afterwards that drew me to you. And I love the fact, actually, that you have been very diverse within your career, that you've done lots of different things, because I empathize. I feel I am that person too. And I'm sure that we would agree that we're still working out, really, what we're doing.
Oh, very, very, very much so. But, you know, here's the difference, is that I am really quite childishly delighted at this point of the figuring out. I because it's like the best game ever. Everything seems possible because I also have the safety of what I actually do. So I can stay with my sort of root or rock or core or whatever and sort of look off in the distance and go, oh, that looks like fun. And if somebody gestures for me to come over, I'm going to go.
Yes.
I might get there and go, you know what? I don't want to do that. So I'm going to go back home. And that's okay. You know, I was talking to somebody recently, since the lockdown, the first lockdown that the UK had, and the arts went, and there were a lot of comments publicly and then privately with myself and friends and colleagues. And the one thing I kept hearing were people, performers, live performers saying, well, this is it. It's all over. And I stood in my kitchen. I was talking to my husband and I said, well, you know, short of like their necks getting slit or somebody cutting off their hands, how is it over? Because you do, I'm assuming, what you love to do. And nobody's stopping you from doing it. It was about, of course, that thing, the live performance, the communication, the audience and so on. But for me, I thought, I got a piano in my house. I'm good. I will keep playing the piano. Maybe somebody one day will be able to come into my house and listen to me play the piano. But I still get to do what I like to do. And that's pretty cool. So I'm good. I'm good. If I have to stay in my house for a little while longer, I'm good, because I will still be playing the piano. And that's really an incredible opportunity. And from that point now, that is my base. I get to play the piano and I like to play the piano. I will be playing the piano unless somebody cuts off my hands. Otherwise, everything else is a bonus. And I know this, it sounds a little bit sort of Disney-esque or whatever, but after 4 decades of just playing the piano, this is fantastic. Now it's wonderful. Everything else is a kick. Get to play with my friends, get to play in places, and I still come home and play for myself. That's pretty good.
So yeah. It's freedom. It's finding freedom within what you love. And I think that the lockdown became a meltdown for lots of people. But I think it is true that we did need to recalibrate in such a way that we did find out really essentially what we love by missing some of it, certainly by missing some of it.
Yes. And I don't think I would have perhaps come to the same conclusion if I hadn't done what I'd done before. If
yes,
I hadn't had that kind of intense life and, you know, competitions and studying and the endless hours of practice, of course I wouldn't have been able to experience, I suppose, this kind of freedom. So this goes back to the doing the Beethoven. You may not want to do it, but do it. You know, it's not going to be the end of your life. And when I was telling my kids doing their GCSEs, you know, here's the thing. Just pass the physics exam. You never have to do physics again after this. But do the work. Just do the work. Do the best you can do. And then it's done. And that's okay. And then you never have to open a physics book again. I never did. I passed my exam, so that's all right.
I love it. I think this has been a conversation of looking at how to enable, how to listen, where the boundaries are, where the freedom is, where imprisonment is in ourselves, what fear actually means, and how to get over it all, really. And to realize that no matter how old we are and whoever we are, that we really can embrace opportunities throughout our lives that really may surprise us. And I think for both of us, we know what that feels like right now in our lives. And I agree, it's a childish, childlike kind of glee, just thinking, well, I don't know what's around the corner. But if something does come towards me and I think that I'm going to go and ride on that bus, then I'm going to do it. And
absolutely,
that's a wonderful thing. It really is a wonderful thing.
I realized that certainly in the past year that I've been, and because of the state of the nation and the nonsense that's going on in this world, that kindness has just been the most important thing to me. And I just don't understand how people cannot be kind, because it's such a waste of time to do anything else, you know? And it doesn't, it gives me such pleasure. It is, I mean, perhaps it's selfish, but it gives me such pleasure to be nice to somebody and watch them just relax. And it's not that difficult to do. That's the thing. You know, if something's driving you crazy, then walk away. Go do something else. Life is too short for all of this. Definitely.
Yeah.
You know?
This conversation has been an absolute delight. I really hope that we have the excuse to see each other and to talk again at some point.
But absolutely. I hope so. This is brilliant. But thank you for asking me. This is fantastic.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
So cool.
Thanks so much for coming on board for this conversation. There are many more I can't wait to share with you, so do click the subscribe button. And if you want to come and find me on Instagram or Patreon, and I definitely hope to see you here really soon. Thanks so much.